This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Lost in the Wild, Danger and Survival in the North Woods, by Carrie J. Griffith, narrated by Roger Wayne. Prologue. Wilderness is a word we use very carelessly. The bogs of the Gunflint region are the only true wilderness in this area, undisturbed, obscure, and a little otherworldly. Bogs are mossy grottos of silence. John Henriksen. Gunflint. The Trail. The People. The Stories. Bogs. Northeast of the Powwow Trail. Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness. BWCAW. Early afternoon. Wednesday. October 24, 2001. There are still 2 hours of sunlight, more than enough time to make it back to camp, providing he can find it. Jason Rasmussen pushes through another section of brush, searching for his tent and supplies. He should have crossed his camp hours ago. Instead, he has been hiking since just before noon. It's almost 4. At least the rain hasn't restarted, he thinks. He slogs through yet another thick patch of forest, hoping he will find a long stretch of water. The narrow lake at whose north end he was camped. If he can find it, he can find his tent. If he can locate his tent, he can light a fire, get out of these wet clothes, and have something to eat. At this point, he knows the food will make him feel better. He can already taste the freeze-dried gourmet teriyaki chicken. And what if I don't find the tent? He doesn't let himself contemplate the devastation. He knows it is foolish to castigate himself for not packing matches in his waste pack, along with the crackers, tuna, whistle, and knife. Idiot, he thinks before he can choke the thought. He pauses, opens his waste pack, and again rummages through its contents. He pats his coat and pants pockets, just to be sure. No matches. Bushwhacking in wet woods has left him soaked and cold. But if he finds the lake... 20 yards ahead, he sees light. There's a break in the tree line. He has finally found that hidden stretch of water. He allows himself one brief moment of hope. He pushes through the edge of brush. A sense of divine intervention, of deliverance, starts to wash over him. He can practically feel his fire's warmth. He bursts out of the forest wall and sees it. Another bog. He is stunned. He stares at it, wondering if it is only a dream. A nightmare. His third bog in 2 days. He looks across its surface. This one appears more solid than the two he crossed yesterday, and it's narrower. He looks to his left, but the bog's treeless, flat surface stretches as far as he can see. He looks to the right and sees the same interminable gap. There is no way he can walk around it. Yet he feels certain that just beyond this bog he'll encounter the lake, his lake, stretching in front of his camp like a broad, clear boulevard. But bogs are dangerous. Jason Rasmussen is not a seasoned wilderness hiker. But this much he knows. Bogs are masses of floating vegetation, rivers and islands of floating grass hummocks. They can be anchored in spots, making the ground appear firm. You can place your foot on what appears to be solid ground, and it can feel solid. But when you give it your full weight, the thin vegetal surface can suddenly yawn and disintegrate, and you can drop like a rock into whatever depth of water lies beneath. Jason envisions the sudden break, the plunge, the weightless feel of his body as it falls into freezing water, not touching bottom, kicking to the surface as he watches the last glint of sunlight disappear between closing sphagnum lips. Come on, he catches himself. Get hold of yourself. What's up with all the negativity? He reminds himself of yesterday's bog-crossing success, and Jason knows he has to cross this one. There is no other way. He knows his lake, camp, and supplies rest just beyond that next rise. He can feel it, and the afternoon is getting on. He is cold, wet, tired, and hungry. The Tootsie Rolls he ate over an hour ago have done little to quiet his stomach's growl. He searches for a test stick. He picks up a long tamarack bough and trims it down to a sturdy 5-foot pole. He takes his first step, prodding the bog's grass and fern surface. It gives, but just barely. He steps onto it. It holds. Across the 20-foot gap, he can see plenty of foot-wide pockmarks filled with black water, but he can also see several probable footholds through the honeycombed maze. He pushes his test pole forward. He finds another firm hummock and steps onto it. It gives, but holds. He continues crossing the bog, first testing with his long pole. Twice the heavy staff breaks through the grassy surface. Both times he backtracks, chooses alternative routes to the left and then right, searching for more solid ground. Both times he moves forward. Finally, he comes to within 7 feet of the far edge, too far to jump. He pushes the pole forward, testing, probing the tangled surface. It holds. He realizes he can jump from his current position, plant a foot on the solid patch, and close the distance between that hummock and the bog's edge with one strong leap. That is just what he tries. He leaps forward 5 feet, feels the hard bottom of his hiking boot hitting solid turf, and then it starts to give. With sickening panic, he feels his foot sink. The cold water envelops his boot top, clams around his ankle and shin. His other foot is moving forward, searching for solid ground. He lurches forward. His first foot plunges into the hummock. His other foot searches in vain for something solid, and then it, too, disappears beneath the widening black water. For one brief moment, while the momentum of his body carries him across the bog's edge, he is knee-deep in mucky swamp, and then he falls in a shattered heap on the opposite shore. A groan squeezes out of him as though someone has slammed him hard in the center of his stomach. He gets up, stamping his feet, trying to shake them free of the freezing water. He looks down at his soaking pant legs. They cling to the contour of his calves. Water runnels off them, pooling in his boots. "God damn it," he swears. Darkness is coming fast. The thought rises unbidden. "In 1 hour you're going to be wandering in the dark, and it could get cold. It could get very cold. You could freeze to death." He exhales and notices his breath cloud in front of his face. He looks back over the bog, then forward. He is wet, tired, plenty cold already. The bog water feels as though it has soaked into much more than the bottoms of his shoes. Its icy fingers pull at the inside of his body, at his heart, at his spirit. He collapses on the side of the boggy bank. He doesn't want to push forward through another stand of low-hung tamarack, alder, and stunted, leafless black ash. It looks like a wall behind him, an impenetrable wall of wilderness brush. Suddenly he's claustrophobic, barely able to breathe. He begins to wonder if he will ever find his way out of these woods. Tears start rimming his eyes. His vision blurs. He can't see anything. He cannot see the bog in front of him, the forest through which he came, even the ground in front of his face. He feels disoriented. He knows he should have long ago recovered his camp. He feels the panic he has kept at bay for the last 2 hours is starting to rise. The huge body of an invisible wilderness weighs on him. He can feel its heaviness on his chest. He can feel his temples pound. He slumps on the edge of the bog and tears spill from his eyes, creasing his haggard face. He came to the woods for solace. He wanted respite and wilderness solitude. He cannot believe it has come to this. He can't believe anything. He tries to get hold of himself, tries to calm his hiccuping desolation, to recover his reason. But there is nothing. A huge emptiness settles over his heart, over his entire self, a final desperation, and wrenching words surface from this depth. "What am I going to do? What in God's name am I going to do now?"
Bell Lake Environs, Quetico Provincial Park, Ontario. Wednesday afternoon, August 5, 1998. Dan Stevens stumbles south all afternoon, penetrating deeper into remote brush. When he remembers his friends, he calls out, but the sudden vibration coming up from his throat intensifies his head throb. And besides, no one ever responds. An interminable insect whine follows him. He hears occasional bird songs. He walks deeper into the wilderness, wondering if there's a lake. He crosses more small creeks and stagnant bogs. He pushes through the marshy region. He has trouble recalling that just 5 hours earlier, he
He was leading a group of scouts from Chattanooga, Tennessee, down the Quetico's man chain of lakes. He can barely remember who he is. Dan Stevens, an Eagle Scout from Georgia, spending the summer of his 22nd year leading scout groups out of the Northern Tier High Adventure Camp in Ely, Minnesota. He remembers this much about his Chattanooga group. There are two fathers and six kids. Until this trip, none of them had ever set foot in the North Woods. One of the fathers had been on other scouting trips, but he moved like an aging bear and was ill-suited, at least by current health, to spend a week paddling and portaging. The other father was a reasonable hand with a paddle, but he had spent little time in the wilderness. In spite of their inexperience, the Chattanooga group had been his summer's best. From their first day out, they felt as comfortable as old friends, though Dan could see they would be lost without him. Dan remembers he was with the group. He remembers some of their names and faces. He recalls the man chain and their ultimate destination, Prairie Portage on the Canadian border. But there are still 30 miles of hard paddling in front of them, and it would be at least 2 more days before they reach it. What he can't quite figure out is why he now stumbles alone through lowland bush and swamp creased by waterways and bogs, waving away bugs. Near late afternoon, he comes to a U-shaped lake. He is tired and hungry and not entirely clear-headed about where he is or how he got here. He pauses at the shore, hoping to regain his bearings. He sits for an hour, trying to rationalize his position. He knows he is not thinking clearly. He needs to get an unfettered look from some place high enough to give him a reasonable vista. Near the lake, an old-growth white pine stretches skyward, offering a panoramic view of the area, Dan assumes, if he can climb it. He considers the lower branches. This one has enough hand and footholds to make climbing a possibility. He walks around the tree in the shade, locates the most viable route upwards, and starts to climb. 15 minutes later, he is almost 50 feet off the ground. From his aerie, he has a wide view of the surrounding country. He can see a medium-sized lake with a longer, larger lake beyond it. By dead reckoning, he surmises the lakes lie west or southwest. He guesses the longer lake is Other Man, and is comforted by finding a lake he remembers from the map. He thinks it is probably the best place to turn. If he can make it to Other Man, a common route for those traversing the man chain, he might encounter his group, or some other group paddling down the chain. He descends the tree, takes his bearings, and stumbles ahead, pushing through more swamp. In a few places, he has to turn to avoid boggy patches or open water, and in this lowland area, the brush is particularly thick, but he tries to maintain his direction. It is heavy slogging for another 45 minutes, maybe an hour. He loses track of time. He hasn't checked his watch, but at the very least he thinks he should have run into or rounded the smaller lake before Other Man. He should be close. But after he has been hiking for what seems like well over an hour, all he sees in front of him is more swamp and bog. He approaches the edge of an old beaver pond. The area is boggy and stunted with low-hung willow, cattails, and thick marsh grass. The tall grass surrounds a large pond-bog complex. Another white pine rises over the pond's edge. It has a scraggly head, but otherwise angles out over an outcropping of rock and appears scalable. Dan climbs up to have another look, trying to discern his position. When he looks west, he sees the larger lake farther south. He realizes he has angled in the wrong direction, probably north-northwest. He is stunned. He has increased the distance between himself and Other Man. He cannot believe it. He castigates himself, cursing. Idiot! He can hardly believe he angled through the swamp until he was walking in almost the exact opposite direction from the way he should have been heading. He was sure he was hiking west-northwest. Instead, he has slogged through at least a half mile of swamp, hiking almost due north. He looks down, shaken by the realization, and curses again. He climbs out of the tree. It doesn't feel like the right place to reconnoiter, but reason has at least reasserted itself enough to convince him he should stay put till he figures out some kind of plan. He comes down to the edge of the old beaver pond. It looks clear in the late afternoon sun. His head still hurts. He kneels beside the water to fill his collapsible canteen. When he leans over, his head aches, and a brief bout of vertigo threatens to relieve him of this morning's oatmeal and gorp. He sits and waits for the nausea to pass. He is beginning to realize his predicament. He is in the middle of a swamp, with not much of an idea where to turn. He had not considered it, but now he looks around in the late afternoon, and it dawns on him. He may have to spend the night in darkness, in wilderness, alone, under the stars. As if in answer, a small cloud of bugs rises like a fist to his face. He waves them away and turns to be rid of them. His head is still splitting, with a knot on his forehead the size of a loon's egg. He knows he is not thinking clearly, but he also knows the sun is going down and dusk brings out the bugs. He recalls stories of moose and deer driven to frenzy by swarms of black flies and mosquitoes. Seeking relief, they would swim into the middle of lakes where some of them, rather than return to shore in the swarms, would tread water until they finally weakened and drowned. He peers around the edge of the pond and wonders what he will do when dusk settles. He knows the end of the day ushers in one good hour of bugs, maybe more. And he knows this night there will be no netting or nylon or rim of firelight and smoke or bug juice to keep them in abeyance. People who have not lived through pestilential swarms do not know they can separate a person from sanity and reason. And it is this knowledge that focuses Dan's eyes over his lowland swamp, searching for some kind of shelter, some place to hide. First Steps. Hiking here is like going back in time to the Stone Age. At least, that is the feeling I got hiking among the harsh bedrock lakes with intriguing names like Superstition and Rock of Ages. John Pakite, Hiking Minnesota. If it had not been for my care in protecting my eyes, these fierce creatures would have blinded me many times. It had happened so to others, who lost the use of their eyes for several days, so poisonous is their stinging and biting to those who have not yet become acclimatized. Gabriel Sigard Tioda, The Long Journey to the Country of the Hurons. 1. Preparation. Twin Cities REI. Sunday, October 21, 2001. Jason Rasmussen walks under REI's pine bole and iron beam archway separating the parking lot from the store near the Mall of America. For the second time this week, he passes a large sign on his left proclaiming, Gunflint Lake, elevation 470 meters, BWCAW-Quetico, Minnesota-Ontario. Like everything else in this place, it reminds him of outdoor adventure. He continues across the narrow courtyard and steps over a footbridge. An artificial waterfall cascades over stones into a small pool. On this late fall day, the water is littered with yellow birch leaves, giving the place a North Woods feel, reminding Jason why he has come. As it had for so many others, the catastrophe of September 11, 2001 altered his travel plans. For over a year, the third-year medical student from the Medical College of Wisconsin-Milwaukee had been training for a trek in Nepal. His REI Adventures tour was scheduled to leave in October, his rotation month off. Now that his tour has been canceled, he has unexpected time on his hands and a yearning to walk in wild places. He needs to get away. He needs to go someplace where he won't smell antiseptics or see fluorescent lighting or classrooms. The Nepalese trek for which he had trained so assiduously was going to satisfy his thirst for remote adventure, for some place entirely different. Now more than ever he needs wilderness, and the solace it has provided him in the past. He had lived in Minnesota until he was 10. Then his family moved to California, where he finished high school and attended community college before returning to attend the University of Minnesota, and then the medical college. And in all that time he never once had a chance to set foot in the North Woods. It is an absence he has regretted. He thinks his visit to REI can help him sort out a destination and a plan. He grabs hold of the canoe paddle handles and opens the massive doors, looks up at the 55-foot climbing wall. It's difficult not to admire the glass-enclosed wall. On the outside, large beams stick out of the roof, the REI landmark. From either side, down a considerable stretch of Interstate 494, the protruding spikes beckon like half of the Statue of Liberty's crown. And for many, including Jason Rasmussen, that's what this store means. freedom, the special call of wild places, and 21st century technology that will take you there in style and bring you back safe. Jason enters the store. He admires the colorful resin-based kayaks and Kevlar canoes hanging from ceiling rafters. Old town, shadow, perception, wilderness. Even the names convey adventure. Racks of the finest outdoor merchandise in the world line store aisles. He sees paddle gear, winter sportswear in vibrant primary colors, waterproof duffels, pullovers, pants, and socks that wick away sweat. There are boots lined with Thinsulate, small layers of light and warm hyperinsulation surrounded by Gore-Tex, a semi-permeable layer that breathes out but prevents water from penetrating. REI's layout forces you to amble through much of the store. Around the corner to accessories, a small display of wristwatches, sunglasses, high-end compasses, GPS devices, Leatherman and Swiss Army knives, windproof lighters, compact digital cameras with built-in binoculars. Down the aisle he sees yellow, light green, and orange tents pitched on the cement floor. Across from them hang camping stoves and several racks of bottled gas. Beyond the tents are mittens, gloves, hats, gaiters, and still further down, backpacks. Gore-Tex, nylon, polypropylene, Camelback, Valhalla, the North Face. The latest gear made from the best stuff man can cultivate or conjure, and named by someone with a flair for merchandising the wild. Winter is coming on, and Jason knows he'll have to dress warmly. But with equipment like this, much of which has already accumulated in anticipation of his Nepalese trek, his only concern is which freeze-dried gourmet meal he'll cook for dinner. In the camping section, he talks to one of REI's helpful attendants. This one he knows, an old algebra teacher from his hiatus year at Normandale Community College, when he was establishing residency before enrolling at the university. Like many of REI's attendants, his former instructor is moonlighting, not so much for money, but for the love of wild places and the conversation it engenders, and a discount on REI goods. REI doesn't have salespeople. It has consultants. Jason tells him he is thinking about heading up north, preferably to the Boundary Waters, for a 3-day hike, and his old prof takes him to a rack of books. He pulls down John Pakite's Hiking Minnesota, and shows Jason the Powwow Trail, a 26-mile-long circular hike that puts in near Isabella Lake and immediately crosses into the Boundary Waters. It meanders through spruce, pine, poplar, and, as the book describes, remote bedrock lakes, beaver dams, and cascading creeks. That's it. He can tell just from the description and the way the trail line curves over the page in a wobbly circle, crossing small lines of creeks, edging along pine symbols, with plenty of small tents signifying campsites. He glances over the section describing the terrain. Difficult. Western side composed of rough and tumbled trails. Jason has hiked in woods before and knows what to expect. He has a good map and compass and knows how to use them. But Pakite's book was published in 1998, a full year before the July 4 blowdown storm that altered large tracts of BWCAW forest, making some of it impassable. In fact, 3 years later, areas around the Powwow Trail had grown up so dense you would need a machete and a chainsaw to get through. Pakite's text identifies some of the trail's complicated background and significant challenges. The Powwow was developed in 1977 by the Youth Conservation Corps. Rather than plot and cut an entirely new path, they made use of a maze of old logging roads that crisscrossed the boggy country east of what was then the small town of Forest Center. But the bogs finally prevailed, forcing them to move the entire trail system west, where the country was for the most part drier and better suited to hiking and backcountry camping. There are still plenty of places where the path is questionable, marked by fallen trees and rugged country. The wise, Pakite advises, will rely on a good compass, map, and serious orienteering skills. Jason doesn't ignore these lines, but he skims over them, feeling a greater appreciation for trail descriptions that speak to the kind of hike he imagines. If you go, you will be treated to special lakes that you have nearly all to yourself. He is left with a vague notion of hiking through quiet woods and finding the solitude he desires. He notes the book, and another entitled Wilderness Survival. This one is a small pamphlet, light enough to carry, and with enough information so that the entire text is worthwhile. He places it with his other items. He walks over to REI's map section, where the consultant shows him the yellow and blue fisher maps, familiar to anyone who hikes or fishes the wild places in northern Minnesota. They find the one containing the detail of the powwow trail and surrounding area. Spreading the map out on a table nearby, he can clearly see the entire area, including elevations and streams. He smiles, contemplating the fall hike through cool woods, the air crisp, the sky a perfect blue. In the cities, the week has been one of those easy transitions from season to season, when the days are warm and the leaves hang on, lulled by the false promise of Indian summer. Beside the Fisher maps are Mackenzie maps. If you hike along the circular portion of the trail counterclockwise, the first 2 miles move north-northeast in a near straight line. Then the trail angles sharply left almost 90 degrees, moving north-northwest. A small dotted line continues along the north-northeast route, indicating the path of the old trail, the one the Pukite text described as originally forged along old logging roads east of Forest Center. That part of the trail was later abandoned and moved to the western half, drier region. The Fisher map shows the same 90-degree turn to the left, but not the faded continuation of the line depicting the original powwow trail. But Jason Rasmussen doesn't look at the Mackenzie map. He rolls up the familiar yellow and blue map, and on his way out gathers a few more items for his trip. At the last minute, he fingers a small orange whistle, the kind you can hang around your neck on a colorful lanyard. He thinks about it, wondering if he really needs it. Like most things in this store, it is expensive. $4.95 for a little piece of plastic. Jason peers at the product description, smiling while he wades through the marketing hype that will tell him why an orange plastic whistle costs almost $5. It was rated at 118 decibels. Exceeds U.S. Coast Guard and SOLAS regulations, he reads. SOLAS regulations? He flips the package over. Safety of life at sea. But he is not going to sea. He is walking into the woods. Surrounded by so much high-tech equipment, all designed to bring us closer to the wilderness but make our journeys comfortable and safe, it is easy to forget that people still hike into woods, get lost, and die. Jason conjures an image of the 1 million-acre wilderness as one vast, undulating sea of forest and lake. He pauses over the orange whistle, finally tossing it into his basket with its accompanying orange lanyard. Then he turns and walks toward the checkout. He has been camping before, he reminds himself. Plenty of times. His family has camped in California, and he's been camping with friends in local parks and in Wisconsin. He knows how to use a compass and a map. And though he has never seen the North Woods, he has always wanted to get up there. This is his perfect chance. He continues toward the checkout, content with his purchases, excited about his trip. The other effect of touring REI, among so many people bent in similar pursuit and among so much gear and merchandising, is to heighten Jason's enthusiasm for his adventure. As he waits in line, he picks up a disposable camera, something to record his adventure, and then moves to the open cashier. On Quinn Road in West Bloomington, a suburb south of Minneapolis, his parents' wide-sloping redwood house backs up to a small stand of trees. There are Berber carpets, tiled floors, stairs to the left, stairs to the right, and plenty of windows in the front and back, opening onto trees. His mom, Linda, sits in her kitchen and listens to his directions. "Here's where I'm headed," he says, looking into her clear, penetrating eyes, just like those he sees in the mirror. He opens Pukite's book and shows her the powwow trail. "Looks beautiful," she says. She is only slightly worried. This isn't the first time Jason has walked into the woods alone. He knows it is dangerous. Most camping and instructional guides advise against it. But sometimes, particularly at this time of year when no one else is available, the only alternative is going solo. And besides, she knows her son. Jason is a driven, determined kid. Once he sets his mind on something, he pursues it with a remarkable degree of focus, and single-mindedness. When he was young, he attended high school in Southern California, where Lee, his dad, was working for the Menin Company. At the time, California schools had few rules and fewer expectations. Like most kids who were preoccupied with everything but what they planned to do with their lives, Jason skated. He coasted through his high school career, uncertain of his future and what he wanted to do with it. Then, in his 2 years at Orange County Community College, he met a professor who turned his head toward the compelling world of science. It was a moment of epiphany. He became absorbed in his classes. He began to study. At the end of his 2 years at Orange County, he did well enough to have the audacity to contemplate a career in medicine. When he shared the idea with his parents and his younger sister, Heidi, they smiled, somewhat incredulous. But they supported his efforts. His newfound ambition was in marked contrast to his high school drifting, and as unlikely as a career in medicine sounded, his parents welcomed the change. And then he shocked everyone by his sustained, unremitting effort. He struggled with math and science, but gradually absorbed them. By the time he entered the University of Minnesota in his junior year, he was an academic sponge, and he did well. He enrolled in all the math and science allowed. He remained focused, and his efforts were rewarded. But the MCATs, the medical school entrance exams, are difficult. It took Jason 3 years to finish his coursework and score high enough to be admitted to med school. Linda and Lee had always been impressed by their son's ambition and perseverance. He had worked damn hard to overcome a mediocre secondary education, and he succeeded, largely by the sweat of his own brow. Lee, who has run in over 20 marathons, knows plenty about hard work. At this point, Linda knows Jason does, too. She's not too concerned about his solo adventure into the cold North Woods.
"It's only 3 days," he reminds her.
"It's a shame about Nepal," she muses.
"It will be beautiful up north. This time of year I'll have the woods to myself."
"Just be careful, Jason. It could get cold."
"I've got it covered," he says.
And he does. He has the compass, the Fisher map, the trail description and map from the Pukite text, and plenty of the right gear. He has a polypropylene pullover, a red flannel shirt, a sweater, a light Gore-Tex North Face windbreaker with a pullover hood. He has nylon hiking pants with an insulated layer and water-resistant polyurethane coating. He has good boots, a down bag rated for temperatures as cold as 10 degrees below zero, an air mattress, a waterproof tent with a bright orange tent fly, wool socks, plenty of food, a camp stove, 2 canisters of white gas, the charcoal lighter from his parents' grill, his orange whistle with the lanyard he can hang around his neck. He packs Tootsie Rolls, crackers, canned tuna, and enough freeze-dried food to last a week. His mom glances at the Pukite map again, sees the 26-mile circle with plenty of campsites. The trail meanders through a string of small lakes. Pose, South Wilder, North Wilder, Horseshoe. She imagines glades sloping down into clear, still water, park-like conditions.
"Here's where I plan to hike," Jason explains, pointing to the start of the trail on the map. "It's over 2 miles to the circular part of the trail. Then I'll walk counterclockwise for another couple of miles and camp the first night near Pose Lake."
He points to it on the map. He traces the wobbly line along the north side of the circle, ending at a tent symbol near Rock of Ages Lake.
"Here the second night," he says. "That's a pretty good hike, but I should be able to do it."
He will camp near Marathon Lake the third night, and then exit the next day. If he has time, he'll explore the Superstition Trail Spur, a 1 mile round-trip side trail that's supposed to be scenic and haunting. And this is important, he thinks, figuring the time it will take to hike out.
"I should be out Thursday afternoon. I'll call you."
"Okay,"
she nods, comforted by his plan and the places she can see on the map. It looks like a good itinerary, and she knows her son's determination and strength. She looks forward to his Thursday afternoon call. He considers the trail and the time he's given himself. Plenty. He'll be out well before noon on Thursday, so calling shouldn't be a problem. "If you don't hear from me by Thursday evening," he says, knowing his mom will appreciate his care,
Call the Lake County Sheriff's Office. He doesn't write down the phone number, because he doesn't really believe the need will arise. He mentions it to her as a minor precaution, something more to comfort his parents than from his own genuine concern. "I'm sure everything will be fine," he says. "But if you don't hear from me by Thursday evening," he repeats emphatically, "call the sheriff." Jason knows the likelihood of anything going wrong is remote. But things do happen. The history of Northwoods travel is littered with stories of those who walked into wilderness to find satisfaction for their yearning for wild places, solace, scenery, or replenishment, and found something else entirely. 2. Hidden Portage. A nameless lake between Fran and Bell, Quetico Provincial Park, Wednesday, August 5, 1998. Well before noon, Dan Stevens and the group of 8 scouts he is leading carry their canoes down the slope into the northeast end of a lake with no name. They are glad to have the portage behind them. Fran Lake had been crystalline in the mid-morning sun. In the faint breeze it had been like crossing mottled blue lapis. But the 76-rod portage out of Fran was difficult to find, overgrown, uphill, and bug-infested. The morning left the group hungry and ready for lunch. "These remote crossings are tough," Stevens thinks. Doug Hurdler from the Summers Canoe Base had told him the next one, from No Name Lake into Bell, was well concealed and might take some time to find. Now Dan squints across the azure sparkle, trying to discern its whereabouts. The scouts blow and wave away the bugs. The pests are thick and persistent, and the paddlers are anxious to get onto the water and be rid of them. Aside from the bugs, it is practically paradise. The lake ripples under a light breeze. Occasional pillows of high cumulus clouds float like gauzy cotton across an azure dome. The wide, diamond-shaped waterway stretches out in front of them, bordered by cedars and pines that grow in thick profusion to the lake's edge. In a few places, there are tiny gaps in the green where giant slabs of igneous rock drop into aquiline. It is typical terrain for this part of the Quetico, haunting and resplendent, where everything but the water has a sharp edge. At 22, Dan Stevens is spending his summer up from Athens, Georgia, as a group leader for the Charles L. Summers Canoe Base / Northern Tier High Adventure Scout Camp near Ely, Minnesota. It is not Stevens' first time guiding. 6'2", 165 pounds, he is lean and tall, with a serious, quiet look that conveys intelligence, a core of inner strength, and an abiding love for wild places. His long, unkempt hair hangs over his collar. His chin sports a ragged length of beard that makes him look more Amish than Eagle Scout. He wears a black T-shirt under his blue and black PFD vest. The high-tech personal flotation device is a constant requirement for the group, one of Dan's few absolute rules. He wears green khaki nylon hiking shorts and lightweight shoes. He doesn't have the look of an eagle from Athens, but he is one. This group of 8 from Chattanooga have appreciated both his expertise and his Georgia drawl. When they arrived in northern Minnesota, none of them expected to find a southern boy in the Canadian woods. Instead of a Yankee, their guide has a disarming southern smile and more skill with a paddle than any of them have ever seen. He can canoe all day, find and set up camp, catch, clean, and cook some of the best-tasting fish they have ever eaten, and he's a leader. His abilities, appearance, quiet demeanor, and habit of journaling toward the end of the day haven't gone unnoticed. There is admiration in the young scout's eyes. They appreciate their Georgian guide and depend on him more than they realize. But the morning of portaging and paddling has tired his crew, and he can tell they're getting edgy. Before reaching Fran, they had crossed a shallow lake that in places was only 6 inches deep. Dan and his group leaders, Jerry Wills and Tim Jones, the only two fathers, had to get out and slog their canoes through moose muck. The fathers didn't say it, but Dan could see the pull had wearied them. Since leaving Summers Canoe Base on Sunday, he had pushed them. The group's entry permit into Canada was for Tuesday, August 4. They had to be at the Cache Bay Ranger Station their third day out, so they had paddled 17 miles the first day, crossing moose, sucker, birch, and carp lakes,
and then camp that first night on Robin's Island in Knife Lake. The next day they paddled 15 miles along the international border, up the thick length of Knife, entering Otter Track at the Little Knife Portage, and leaving it at the Monument Portage, where the group took photos of the marker at the U.S.-Canadian border. That evening they camped on a small peninsula at the southwestern end of Saganaga. The next morning they paddled 12 miles up the southwestern end of Saganaga and into huge Cache Bay, finally making the ranger station in the early afternoon. They were thankful for reaching the station with plenty of day still before them. They enjoyed visiting the outpost, where the scouts could buy souvenirs and where Doug and Janice Matichuk, the husband and wife ranger team, were friendly and informative. Dan shared their route with the rangers as the two fathers listened in. Janice said it was a beautiful string of lakes, but she warned them about sticking to the portages, some of which were well concealed.
"A few weeks back, a kayaker couldn't find a trail and decided to bushwhack it," she said. "Disappeared."
She waited for the words to penetrate.
"The others came back and got us. We went out and found him, but it reminded me how thick these woods can be, particularly this year with so much rain."
From the looks of the sky northwest of the station, there was more rain coming their way. Their next stop was Silver Falls Portage, over a mile across open water in Cache Bay. Dan didn't want to get caught in the open. It was going to be a rough paddle across the bay. They said their goodbyes and started out over the lake. The wind came up ahead of the storm, and their narrow crafts struggled across the whitecaps. If they didn't paddle, the blow pushed them backwards or whipped their canoes sideways and threatened to capsize them. They dug in hard against the wind with no alternative but to muscle their way across, their limbs burning from the effort. Thankfully, the heavy rains passed north of them, showering the portage but leaving them dry. The Silver Falls Portage was a breath-stealing 130 rods from Saganaga Lake to Saganagans. It was never an easy portage, and now it was muddy. At its start, they had to scale some large, slippery boulders. Then there were plenty of ups and downs, ferrying packs, gear, and the canoes down the muddy trail. The cataract thundered beside them. The trail was difficult and long, all of it picturesque, but none of it a cakewalk. By the time they reached its end, they had descended over 500 vertical feet from the trail's start back on Saganaga. Their fathers more than carried their load, but at 5 feet, 6 inches, and 210 pounds, Jerry Wills was struggling. The barrel-chested Tim Jones, 6 feet, 4 inches, was more than equal to the task, though he, too, slipped and slid for much of the descent, balancing a canoe over his head, his heart pumping and his lungs working hard. The kids, 17-year-olds Sean Jones, Tim's son, Matthew Thompson and Jake Spann, 18-year-old Justin White, and the younger Jesse Cates and David Schellebarger, pitched in as if they were born to the task. Stevens considers it his best group this summer, but no doubt about it, the Cache Bay crossing and Silver Falls Portage had taken a lot out of them. After pushing hard for 3 days, they were ready for a break. At the bottom of the falls, Jerry Wills rested near the entrance to Saganagan's Lake, entirely spent. He lay down near the outlook, appreciating the open vista, thankful for the momentary respite. He was glad to have that portage behind him and glad to know they wouldn't be returning this way. There wasn't a snowball's chance in hell he could scale back over those rocks, even without equipment. Jerry spent the vast majority of his days settled in a desk job at the Oak Ridge National Laboratories. Before the trip, he had mild indications that he might have been in better shape. Now the rigorous paddling and exhausting hauls were taking their toll. In a little less than a week, he would return home and complain to his wife about chest pains and tiredness. He would finally acquiesce to a doctor's visit. A week after that, he would undergo emergency open-heart surgery. But today he lay down and rested, thankful for a chance to doze. Dan took the kids to the bottom of the waterfall, and they waded into the torrent. They gripped each other's hands for support while Tim Jones held a rope ready on the nearby shore, should anyone be swept away. The kids loved feeling the power of the white water. The rush and foam was like an ablution, for the moment washing away their fatigue. From the side of the falls, Tim Jones worried. He had noted that Dan was pushing them incredibly hard. But this was the first time he had thought Dan was unnecessarily risking the safety of their kids. Watching the boys wade through the foaming spray, he saw plenty of potential pitfalls. The water was riled and unclear. The boys staggered through the torrent to cross underwater rocks. It didn't take much imagination to see how one of them might be swept away by the current. Tim Jones remembered the collective prayer they had shared with parents and friends before their Chattanooga departure. They had gathered together and asked the Lord to guide them and watch over them on their long journey north and into the woods. Now the recollected prayer beside the Quetico Cataract calmed him, though he still held vigil with his rope. Once they were back in the canoes and on to Saginaw's, everyone eased up and reveled in the amazing scenery. They had found the most beautiful campsite they'd yet encountered, and after they set up camp, Dan let the kids do some fishing. For this part of the trip, they were luckless, but they were fortunate in scenery, location, and their perspective on the western sky. The sunset that evening had been a florid red wonder. When they got up this morning, Dan knew he was going to drive them hard across Saginaw's, Slate, Fran, and an unnamed lake. Then they would ease up at Bell Lake, set up camp, and relax for the rest of the day. He could tell they were ready for some serious R&R. It was going to be another perfect day in the Quetico Woods. Somewhere near the southeastern end of this lake lies their next portage, a 21-rod distance into Bell. They have crossed enough portages to know by sweat and effort the length of a rod, 16.5 feet, or about one canoe length. From what Doug Hurdler told them, the portage is flat. That would make this a reasonable short carry once they find it. This is Stevens's first time paddling the man chain of lakes. Over 10 miles north of the border, deep into the heart of the Quetico, it is not a well-traveled place. He has been warned about this particular portage. "It's near the southeast side of the lake," Hurdler told him. "There's some downed trees and a dead one with a big fork. Look for those. And then you have to take a very middle waterway kind of route," Hurdler explained, in language only a guide could follow. "If you go right through the middle, you can find it. It's the kind of portage we've waded through, tying a rope on and bringing the canoes across shallow connecting water." Stevens knows some of these trails are often a little more than overgrown footpaths, but he's developed a method for locating concealed portages, and he has a knack for orienteering in woods. It is their fourth day out. From the start, it seemed as though they were old friends, close enough, at least, to allow young David in the middle of Stevens's canoe to lead them across No-Name Lake to the portage into Bell. Dan calls to the young scout, "Hey, David, want to guide us?" "Sure," Dave agrees, excited by the prospect. Dan tosses up his compass and the yellow and blue fisher map. He likes to give his scouts a chance to guide. It builds orienteering skills. And all summer his groups have been constant in their requests to have Stevens show them their map coordinates, where they've been, and where they are going. It is a persistence that wearies him. All of his groups have a maniacal hunger for map reading, as though the small outlines of lakes, swamps, rivers, portages, and topographic lines with numbers might somehow explain wilderness, or articulate their experience of wild places. If he can teach David to identify their coordinates, maybe the young man can answer the questions about where they are and where they're headed. Besides, Dan is hungry and wants to get down to the end of the lake. Giving up the map and compass frees his hands for paddling. Once they cross over the portage into Bell, it will be time for lunch. Dan looks around. The other two canoes are 20 yards behind, but gliding up fast. He turns to his own canoe and sees Tim Jones in the bow, ready with his paddle. David sits in the middle, perusing the map. He leans toward them and whispers, "Get your bearings and we'll race 'em." "Yeah," they respond, eager for the contest. "Just a second," David adds, returning to the map. The young scout hesitates, then points the way to where the end of the lake narrows in the distance. "See that point down there?" David says, squinting across the blue water, looking down to take another reading from the map. The others have paddled up beside them. "That's where we're headed." Dan turns and considers the other canoes. In one, he watches Sean Jones, Matt Thompson, and Jake Spann paddling up beside them. In the other, he sees Justin White, Jerry Wills, and Jess Cates coming up behind. The struggling Jerry is not a strong paddler. The canoe full of 17-year-olds will be the competition. But with Tim's whitewater experience and his own strong paddle, they should be more than equal to the task.
Okay, Dan says, grinning.
He waits until his point man has paddle in hand. Then he lunges with his own flat blade, surges forward, and declares, "Last one there has to fix lunch!" Suddenly all three canoes are leaping toward the distant shore. It's not much of a contest. The leader's canoe prevails. The three 17-year-olds aren't far behind. Jerry Wills rests in the middle of the third canoe, making slow progress across the water. They lag more than a football field behind. As the far side comes into view, Dan is sure he sees the portage opening, a path of rocks so clear and level they look like cobblestones. He doesn't see the dead tree fork Hurdler described, but woods change. It could have toppled. This far into the Quetico, finding an infrequently traveled portage on your first try is more luck than skill. They're often marked by nothing more than foot-wide openings in brush or trees or a few extra rocks running into water. On occasion, apparent openings turn into moose trails that dissipate into wilderness after 20 yards. And this year, with the plentiful rain, the lakes, ponds, and rivers have all risen, further obscuring the portages. Dan feels lucky today. The path looks clear, and he can already taste the gorp, a trail mix of nuts, chocolate chips, and dried fruit, Kool-Aid, bannock bread with peanut butter, and a granola bar. He tells his two canoe mates to unload their gear and to get ready to portage. As soon as they land, the bugs start in. Near the water, out in the open, the slight breeze makes it tolerable, but once on the trail it will be difficult to breathe without inhaling the dark pests. The scouts have already smeared on DEET. Dan Stevens doesn't use bug goop. In his summer of guiding, he's learned about the sweet smell of new groups. It takes a while for shampoo and soap to wear off hair and skin, and until it does, his new recruits are beacons for the bugs. If he stays upwind, he won't be bothered. He hikes 20 yards up the path, and it disappears. "Damn," he mutters. "Another moose trail." He returns, and with a group sigh, they reload their canoe. Dan glances up the shoreline and sees what appears to be the portage opening at the edge of a cedar swamp. They cross the distance, beach their canoe, and again unload. The 17-year-olds have beached their canoe near Dan's and are unloading. Jerry Wills is approaching. Dan hoists his canoe over his head and starts in. Tim Jones gathers their packs and falls in behind Stevens. David carries the paddles, poles, map, and compass. This time they get a little farther, but 30 yards in, the trail starts to fade.
"I can't believe it," Stevens says, incredulous.
He looks around and sees a nearby cedar with low-hung boughs. In one swift move, he slides the aluminum craft up onto 8-foot-high branches. He's happy to be out from under the load. The canoe hangs there, held up by graceful green arms. Tim looks ahead and sees Dan parking his canoe, realizes it is another dead end, and turns to tell the others not to unload or follow them up the trail. He retraces the 30 yards to shore. Jerry Wills and his companions are still in their canoe.
"Looks like another moose trail," Jones explains.
The others shrug, knowing the real portage must be nearby. Jerry Wills unfolds his map and takes a closer look. Back in the woods, Dan turns to David and asks, "What's the map say?" In part, it is a rhetorical question. Dan Stevens has stared at Fisher Map F-19 for the last 2 days. He can close his eyes and read its title, Saginaw, Seagull Lakes, and its accompanying key and assorted lake locations with enough clarity to trace it in sand. One thing he has always found disappointing is the way the map's landscape relief ends at the Canadian border. North of that line, there are no indications of swampland, topography, lake depths, or elevations. Just yellow and blue swatches depicting land, lakes, and rivers. Enough, he has long realized, to easily guide him in a canoe, but insufficient to give him an idea of the country they're about to enter until they cross into it.
The map shows it's right around here, David finally answers.
I'm going to do a cloverleaf, Dan says. See if I can find it. The young scout nods.
Okay, he says.
David turns and starts back to the shoreline.
They are familiar with their guide's method for finding obscure portage routes, though none of them have ever followed him into the woods.
Still sitting in the canoe, Jerry Wills reviews his map, but when he sees the young scout walk out and tell them Dan is searching for the trail, he rebukes their young guide, at least to himself.
Bushwhacking, he thinks,
displeased with Dan's decision to strike off and look for their trail through woods as dense as these. He has watched Stevens disappear before, and never worried about it until Janice Matichuk's comments back at the Cache Bay station.
It's easy to get disoriented in this bush, he remembers hearing the ranger say. Make sure you stick to the trails.
Well inside the woods, Stevens peers at his watch. He has practically perfected the cloverleaf method for finding wayward portages. He walks straight into the woods for 1 minute. He glances at his watch several times, shifting through the shadowy trees. Overhead branches block the sky. The heavy network of thick tree roots forms an obstacle course. A half minute into his hike, he squints down at his watch and trips, wrenching an ankle.
Damn!
The bugs are starting to swarm. He needs to find that path. If you know how to wend through swamp trees, 1 minute of walking can take you a considerable distance. He does not notice it, but he can no longer hear his friends back at the shoreline. In his short time bushwhacking, he had covered well over 50 yards. Dan Stevens has been careful to register distinctive points in the terrain. A particular cedar tree, broken near its base. A wrangled fin of large granite boulders bordering one side of the swamp. After 1 minute, he picks a clear point of departure, and then makes a sharp 90-degree turn to his left. Stevens is sure he will cross the trail. He hikes in that direction for another minute, but it fails to appear. He returns to his departure point, hikes in the opposite direction, but after another minute still doesn't find it.
God damn it!
They'll have to paddle further up the shore. He doesn't look forward to returning through that swamp. He angles to his left where the fin of boulders borders the trees. The rocks will be easier walking. And though some of them are large enough to require light climbing, that way is preferable to being eaten among the shadowy, root-plagued cedars. He is almost a football field from his starting point, considerably astray from the angle at which he entered. From here he can see less than 10 feet into impenetrable brush. The bugs are starting to annoy him. He carefully climbs over a near rim of rocks. His wrenched ankle feels tight. He comes to a large boulder, ascends it, and from that vantage point looks to the next low rabble of stone. If he leaps carefully, he thinks, he can just reach that one in the center. He tenses. He springs. In the microseconds it takes to cross 5 feet of air, his stomach registers the miscalculation before he does. And then his feet fall short of the center stone, and he topples headlong into granite. 3. The start of the trail. Powwow Trail, BWCAW, Monday, October 22, 2001. Just after noon, Jason is almost finished with his 4-hour drive north. He passes the Isabella Ranger Station, a low-hung, dark log structure resembling all the other DNR buildings built by Roosevelt's Civilian Conservation Corps. Jason doesn't need to stop. He has his maps and the description of how to get to the start of the Powwow Trail. And just days ago, he had called an 800 number the DNR uses to provide the public with wilderness information. The ranger had explained that this late in the season, people were scarce in the boundary waters. Besides, most people canoed. Jason Rasmussen was hiking. He didn't need to worry about a camping permit. He would have those woods all to himself. Just be careful, the ranger added, warning Jason about the weather, which at this time of year can turn on a dime.
I'm prepared for it, Jason said.
But as he turns off the highway onto Forest Road 177, he sees the 2-inch cover of yesterday's snow spread across the road. In among the trees